And action. 3, 2, 1.
It's rich. It's alive. It's vivid. Stereophonic sound.
Are you fed up with constantly searching for the records you want?
These kids' real teachers are these satanic musical things.
Every one of my records means something. The label, the producer, the year it was made.
I'm teaching you about rock music.
Seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars.
Okay, let's spin a disc.
Howdy, hi, and welcome to all of our Cut by Cut listeners. Thanks for once again tuning in. This here is episode 22. It's going to be Not My Jam, and the entirety of this episode are songs which exist off of all the collective radar of those of us here at Cut by Cut. Not necessarily terrible songs, but things don't feature well in our, or feature often in our playlist. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce the co-host. But once again, I am Eric Carlson. And here is not the Chris that you are so familiar with.
Not the Chris you were expecting.
No.
A completely different Chris.
Not the Chris you need, the Chris you deserve.
Oh.
And this here is Chris Sawyer. And Chris was in a band with me. We heard mention on earlier shows. We were in South County Messenger Service.
That's correct. And I almost sent in our covers of Skulls during the Misfits' first season there, but I didn't.
If you go back and listen to them, I did hide one at the end of one of the episodes.
Did you?
There's a little bit of dead space and the song kicks in.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I never said anything about it because I was either waiting for Danzig's lawyers to chime in or for you to chime in and tell me.
Is that why your house is so barren now? Because Danzig's lawyers finally found you?
He just took all my stuff. Yeah, he's not a nice man. He doesn't go for money. He just goes through your book collection
right.
And makes it his book collection.
And nice
that's how
gentleman.
He rolls. So Not My Jam, I guess what we were thinking about this, again, was songs that were off the beaten path and off of our radar.
I was very happy to get this episode, let me tell you. When you sent me the message that it was Not My Jam, I thought, great, I have to pick a song in a genre that I don't like.
Welcome to the podcast. Here's how you're first going to meet the readers or listeners. Right. People who a song you don't care about.
Well, not just that, but now, like I told you earlier, my YouTube channel is all screwed up because of all the songs that I had to listen to find out which song that was not my jam
was your jam,
was my jam
for this episode. This episode was so... This was probably the hardest episode of any podcast I've put together.
And that's my fault, correct?
No. Actually, it was the topic engine's fault.
That topic engine sucks.
It certainly needs to be recalibrated. And this, if you're wondering where's other Chris, Chris was so intimidated, he took the episode off. He was like, you know what? I'm flying to the middle of America, and I'm going to go do work for a week rather than come in and do this episode.
I suppose that's better than him just saying, I have to get my hair did.
Well, that too. I think that was his other excuse was a mani-pedi.
Yeah.
So, you know.
He pulled them all out, and he went nonstop just to avoid this subject.
He looks great, right? I mean, his fingers look great. His toes look great. It is the Barbie glitter toenail polish that I sometimes fret about, though. Like, I don't, you
it's
know.
It's a little over the top.
I know he can handle it. I mean, I know he's secure enough and that he's strong enough and that he's bold enough and that he sees no norms whatsoever anywhere. But it's hard to say, dude, you got glitter all over the house.
Right. And then you got to clean it up, and glitter just lasts for a day. It gets everywhere.
Oh, it does. Yeah, no kidding.
It's like sand.
Yeah, it's the meanest gift I think you can give is giving the gift of glitter.
Especially if they have to tear open the box and it does not open well, and then it just...
Have you ever done that?
To anyone
somebody
on purpose?
Glitter?
No, but I've had it sent to me.
Have you really?
In an envelope in the very early 90s. I still have no idea who sent me this envelope.
Wow.
It was an envelope with a picture of Anna Nicole Smith.
Okay.
And some glitter. And I opened it up, and there it was. I still have the photograph of Anna Nicole Smith because I don't know where the hell it came from.
So one day, if you're listening to this and you glitter bombed Chris, know that he is patiently awaiting revenge. It was future me.
Oh,
after hearing this show,
yeah.
I did this and went back to the past and sent it to you so you'd have something to talk about.
Why Anna Nicole Smith?
Why not?
Oh, okay.
So the first track, speaking of why, comes from possibly one of the biggest names of the 1980s. Suffice to say,
sure. That's, you know, he was the king of pop.
And I think,
and, you know, it's very difficult to not like one of his songs, I think, even though I don't like the vast majority of his personality and music and the way it was presented, but that he was a pro.
And so the song you chose was?
I chose Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson.
Gonna make a change for once in my life. It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collar on my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street. But not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them need? A summer's disregard, a broken bottle top, and a one-man soul. They follow each other on the wind, you know, 'cause they got nowhere to go. That's the one I want you to know.
So where do you want to start with talking about this? I know that you had mentioned, you know, at this time he was the king of pop.
Right.
He was pretty much ubiquitous. This is off Bad, right?
Right. So this was off his, it's his fifth record or seventh record. I had that written down and now I can't find it. But his seventh.
Some odd number.
Seventh, yes, for an odd gentleman. Mm-hmm. His seventh album, Bad. And it had been 5 years since he released Thriller, which was like, I say game-changing in the pop music culture because it had, that sold a billion records. And
it pretty much owned the radio dial for those 5 years. It wasn't right. Like people were tired of Thriller when Bad came out. Thriller was still putting out hits.
Right, he'd put out a song and then it would last 6 months, and he'd put out another song and it would last another 6 months, and it just, you could do that all the way through. I think the interesting thing about this for me is that, number one, I'm someone who likes music that is more personal. So I like, I got into punk and hardcore because it was bands playing their own songs in their own way. And yes, they did covers and that kind of thing, but Michael Jackson is hired, you know, he got this song from someone else. It was written by Glenn Ballard, who eventually co-wrote and produced Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. And I don't have any idea how to pronounce her name, but Sita Garrett.
Okay.
She's the one who came up with the lyrics for it. And she wanted a song for Michael Jackson. She had been asked to write the song for Michael Jackson. And she wanted something that was different. It was not a Yeah, Baby, I Love You song, which he had pretty much been known for up until that point. And they, you know, I really feel like this signifies a change in Michael Jackson in general. After this, he starts to do, you know, Black and White, and he's got those kind of more thought-provoking songs. Well, you know, are they any good or not? I don't know. But this song is outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
It's mellow. It's got the chorus in it. He's, you know, his all those little, you know, little Michael Jackson things that I don't generally like. In this song, I think it comes across as something kind of genuine. I mean, first of all, the song is written by a woman, mm-hmm. and he's talking about the man in the mirror. You know, and he was under the quote microscope or whatever as a person. You know, how did he view himself? Kind of, etc. But one of the things that I love about this song, if you listen to it from beginning to end, and it's like 6 minutes long or something along those lines, but as the song progresses, you know, it kind of sounds like it starts out with him literally talking to himself, like, I've got to be better.
Yeah.
The world is weird, and the only way to make it better is for me to make it better. And so he starts to say, I'm going to change and be better. And then, like, the music starts to kick in more. You get the snare drum kicks in. You get a little more of the choruses. And then I think, you know, one of the most impressive things about it is at 2 minutes and 50 seconds, they have the pause, then they have the key change, and then the chorus comes in, like the not the lyric chorus, but the actual chorus of people coming in, and they all sing Change at that 2 minutes and 50 seconds. It changes the key, and then the whole song changes and sounds like the world has been changed because he was able to change himself.
Let me hit that 250 right here. This was also really big for Jackson, too, in terms of bringing in that whole gospel choir.
Yeah.
You know, I think he had an actual gospel yes. choir in session.
Yep. The same choir, I believe, that sang on Madonna's Like a Prayer.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I found that when I was looking up the song.
Right.
I see a lot of that. I don't know how I know this song. It's certainly not anything that was ever on my radar growing up.
This was 1987.
But I knew all the lyrics.
Right. There's only four, but true. Still, it's a song that as soon as you hear it, you know it. And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, did you watch the video for it at all?
I did, yeah.
It also earmarks not just a change in Michael Jackson's content of his songs and the idea that he can bring change to the world or that he's starting to use this fame, whatever it is, for greater good. He also barely appears in the video at all.
Right. Actually, I have yet to see him in the video. I know he's in there, but I for whatever reason, I must not be looking at the right moment. It's towards the end, right?
Yeah, and that was completely antithetical to everything in the 80s where it was all about showing the band. And so,
especially him. He was the dancer. He was the front man. He was the songwriter. He was the attention.
Right. This is like the White Album of music videos.
Right.
Where I can do a video and never appear in it, and yet my sound is so ubiquitous or so... so world recognized,
right?
That people know it's a Michael Jackson song. They don't need to see me, so I can use these images, and the images really stand out in amazing stark contrast. There's the stuff from Africa. There's a Ku Klux Klan rally.
Yeah, there's
Martin Luther King. There's
Gandhi and the Nazi. You know, Hitler is in there. I was kind of hoping when I was watching the video, I wanted to see. So since the song is about 5 minutes long, when they do that key change, I think everything after that becomes hopeful. And, you know, he's begun the change by changing himself, which is all anyone can do. And I was hoping in the video that there was a starker contrast between the first half of the song with the African kids, all the malnutrition and suffering and the Ku Klux Klan and Nazi stuff, that after that the video would kind of take that on and it would be more generally positive towards the end.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. And I think that's actually good now that I've thought about it for a while, because even though you change, the concept of changing yourself, you're not going to fix everything.
So. I think you're right. I think the narrative, because when they do that break at 250, that's when the nuclear bomb goes off. There's
right.
an atomic bomb that goes off, and then it's, what is it, like Reagan shaking hands with Khrushchev or
right.
some silly thing. And that concept of... change is difficult, and you're going to slide, and it's going to be messy, and it's going to be hard. But who hasn't had that experience of staring at themselves in the mirror, whether it's a morning after,
right.
whether it's during,
as you're preparing to go somewhere? Even I mean, when you know, if you take any pride in your appearance, at some point you have to look in a mirror and go, "All right, I'm going out to my mom's birthday. Do I look okay? Do I have a ketchup stain on my shirt?" And at that point, do you kind of go, you know, am I ready for this?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's difficult.
Well, it reminds me of a story. Did you ever read any of Henry Rollins' biography stuff or any of his books?
I'm going to turn in my punk card now, but no.
Okay. Well, he tells the story of how he got into weightlifting.
Yep.
And he was in high school, and he was scrawny and sort of... You know, he felt himself to be picked on or the victim, and whether it was or was not, who knows?
I think that's the bottom line of anything, right? Your perspective is all that matters. If you feel like you're being picked on,
then you must be, right?
Yeah.
So he had a teacher who used to walk by and, I guess, smack him in the stomach. You know, we're talking about early 80s here, so it wasn't like, oh no, lawsuit. You know, this is
right.
early 80s education.
That was how we had graduated from smashing people on the knuckles to slapping them in the stomach.
Right. And so he gave Henry a bunch of weightlifting equipment. The guy had been in the Marines, and really, whatever it was, saw something in Henry that he connected with or thought, like, here's a kid who could, you know, if this kid was in the right direction, he could do some good.
Right.
And told Henry to go home and do, you know, X number of these lifts. Like, here's your workout plan. But don't look in a mirror. And I forget the story-wise, I'll say 6 months. But right. It was like, don't look in a mirror for 6 months. Don't acknowledge yourself. Don't look, lift up your shirt and look at your muscles. Don't. It's a slow build.
Right.
And at the end, Henry said he got to the point one day where he was walking down the hall and the teacher went to smack him and Henry didn't buckle.
Yeah.
And the guy said, okay, now go home and look at yourself in the mirror. And he did. And he was like, oh my God, I've got a six pack. Right. I've got muscles. And sometimes it takes us getting out of our own headspace to see ourselves or to just do the work. Don't think about the progress of the work. You know, just do what you need to do to get to where you need to be.
Well, if you focus only on the result at that moment, you're never going to see the cumulative effect, because eventually, you know, it takes 4, 5, 6 months to build that kind of strength anyway. Yeah. Especially if you're this scrawny little kid in high school, it's going to take time. And that's kind of the same concept of this song. You're going to change things, but you're not always going to be different. You know, you have to accept that you're gonna kind of deal with it.
And that change sucks, man. Change is hard. Like, why people react so violently towards it, right? I mean, you mix up one thing in a Star Wars film, and the internet is ready to burn down everything.
Right. They want to take it out of the canon. They're fictional characters.
Right.
If you don't like it, that sucks.
You messed up my $1 million toy advertisement. How dare you?
And my childhood. You've destroyed my childhood.
Your childhood was pretty shaky then, my friend, if that's the case.
Right.
And I don't know. I'm amazed that this song culturally has ingrained itself in my head, having never actively sat down and listened to it. And I guess it just shows how ubiquitous.
Yeah, Michael Jackson was the 80s.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because I never have owned a Michael Jackson record, CD, cassette tape. But I, you know, you put it on and you know 90% of the songs off his record, even though you've never listened to it. Whether it was because MTV only had 10 videos they could play, you know, when we were 10 or 12 years old, and you'd see those every day. But what's weird is that after this record is when he really became the wacko jacko, air quotes going on there, of the 90s, when he was, you know, his best friend was a chimpanzee, and, you know, he did, you know,
I want to be that rich. I want to be that rich where I can just select an animal, a wild animal, to be my best friend.
Where were
now
you
now accepting applications? Do you remember, denied, where were you when you first saw Thriller? Do you remember the video?
I don't. Do you?
Yes.
Where were you?
My parents had a raised ranch, and the carport, the garage, they still had a garage. So it was like this little tiny room next to the garage that we used as our living room.
Yeah.
Like, my parents were not TV people. So their thing was, like, it fits a couch, it fits a TV. It's really uncomfortable. Nobody wants to spend any time there. And it was Halloween. It was
fitting
the big
time.
Premiere,
right,
or for whatever it was. So I don't remember what year it was per se, but I do remember.
Let's say 1983.
Parents had taken my sister out trick-or-treating, and I wanted to stay home and watch it. And my parents were, you know, there was all these kind of, like, you know, in 3 days, Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Right.
And my parents said to me, Eric, you are a sensitive lad. This is going to scare the piss out of you. My parents never said no. They never said don't do it.
They were just foreboding, using their wisdom.
We know where this is going. We've seen the end of this story a million times.
Eric, you're 13. You know what's happening.
Eric, we understand that the ending of Green Eggs and Ham still sends you reeling. So I remember watching it and being mortified. And I think they showed it, according to my memory at least, they showed it once and then they quickly showed it again.
Yeah, I think so.
But it was the full John Landis cut.
Yeah, like 14 minutes or something ridiculous.
It was huge. It had the beginning of because it was during the middle of the Satanic Panic, where D&D was the devil's work and stuff like that.
Right.
And so it had this opening, like, in no way, shape, or form, is this an endorsement of the occult?
Yeah.
Which is so silly by today's standards. And I remember being mortified, but my parents came home and there was no way in hell I was going to fake, like, to let on that I was scared, you know?
So everything's fine.
So we lived by the woods and we had our garbage cans were out in the back by the shed, and there was no light there. And like, it was nothing to open up a garbage can and see a possum hanging out, or to hear raccoons trying to open up the cans and trying to open up the containers and doors.
Nature was all around you.
Yeah, exactly. And my dad, who was just an asshole, was like, here, take this garbage out to the dump if you're not so scared. It took me 45 minutes maybe, you know, go a couple steps, breathe, pull my shit together, go another couple steps, pull my shit together.
Hear a noise, take one step back.
Oh my God. And I remember putting it in, putting the cap on, and just sprinting back to the house. And once I was inside, I, you know, of course I was all safe, and but panting very heavily and like probably ghostly white. And my parents just, okay, I guess you really weren't scared at all. And then, you know, climbing into bed that night. Just, what did I do? Why did I do this to myself? And that's been pretty much my man in the mirror moment for the rest of my life is, why did you do this to yourself? You knew. You know who you are. You know your limits.
You know your limits. Why did you keep surpassing them?
Yeah. And I have no problem. I mean, you want to push your limits, push your limits. I know that it usually tends to bite me in the ass.
Well, I think that's part of this song anyway. Push your limits to change, right? Because like you said, change sucks.
Yeah.
People don't want to change. You don't, you know, especially, you know, as someone who has never had weight issues or anything, you know, you put on a few pounds and now all of a sudden it's like, wait, I'm 45 and I have to lose weight. This sucks.
Yeah.
I don't want to change what I've been doing. I like eating pizza 3 days a week and sitting on my ass.
Those are two of my favorite hobbies, actually.
Right. I know. How are we still in good shape? I don't know.
Well, some of us work out 6 days a week to try to get some kind of mental well-being. So anyway, we're going to go from Man in the Mirror.
I just have one more quick fact.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Michael Jackson's Bad, it was released on my 14th birthday.
Wow. Happy birthday to you.
And Michael Jackson's Bad.
Yes, he is. So we're going from Man in the Mirror
to
a song whose B-side was Man in the Middle.
Yeah. Which we did not know beforehand because you chose this song prior to me choosing my song.
It's a happy coincidence, I think. And so if you don't know what we're about to talk about, I would say buckle up. God damn, that song is...
One of my notes that I have here is that says ABBA is straight up sugar, but not in a bad way. You know what I mean? It's not like saccharin-filled pop music like you'd expect. It's the homemade chocolate chip cookie versus the store-bought brand.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you feel that way about all ABBA?
In general, I mean, I don't listen to a ton of ABBA.
Yeah.
This is not my jam. So... But there are several songs that are, I mean, some of their songs, Dancing Queen?
Dancing Queen, yep.
But the song I would have chosen would have been Take a Chance on Me.
Oh, yeah.
That song is one just amazing song. They really knew how to write a hook. They knew, and the songs were nice and the melodies were good. Everything was really nice about it.
Well, let's also talk about the fact that they were from Sweden, sang in English without sounding like Nico from the Velvet Underground, where they were singing phonetically or where their accents was jarring. They worked within the limits of their speech as well. And I think because the music was so dynamic and that opening piano, you think this song is never going to get happy. You know, like there's never any hope.
It's
all of a sudden it kicks in.
It's very emo at the very beginning, right?
Oh, like, extremely.
Woe is me type of what's happening with our relationship.
And for me, at least, so my experience with ABBA is really strange. It goes back to when I was in Australia. Yeah, I'm the guy who went away for 6 months and won't shut up about it. But ABBA was huge in Australia when I was there. I don't know if it was a revival or if it was...
Because you were there in the early 90s.
Correct, yeah. Or if it was just, they were always just big there. But Priscilla, Queen of the Desert had come out, and so they were using a lot of ABBA and that.
Well, I think there was a, well, I mean, with Priscilla, you know, ABBA was very much associated with a lot of gay culture in the 70s, which is, I think, part of the reason why, quote, unquote, real men never would associate with ABBA, because there was a lot of gay connotations going on there. And Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, obviously, that's that whole culture as well. So I think maybe just that Australians are weirdos.
Well, I think, you know, going back to that concept of...
I don't mean weirdos
of,
like that. So we cut that part out. So,
sorry, all of Australia. Didn't mean to... But for me, at least my take on it is music and masculinity, or music and femininity, is such a strange concept, because music sets out to be music. It sets out to either tell a story or to... fit a mood.
Well, you look at Mick Jagger. Is he masculine? I don't think he is, you know, but the dudes who were broing out against ABBA were Rolling Stones fans, and Mick Jagger is very effeminate, at least.
Well, I remember watching an Anthony Bourdain show, and he was in Sweden, and he made some anti-ABBA comment, and I got really offended. I was like, dude, you're telling me that this band, as far as you're concerned, and I love Anthony Bourdain. I've seen him speak. Oh, yeah. I've got his books. You know, so when someone gives their half in an argument and you're not allowed to respond, this is my response to his half of the argument. If he was here, I would love to have this conversation.
You can pretend I'm Anthony Bourdain then.
Because I don't think that they're any more saccharine. I don't think that they're any more pop. I don't think that they're any more effeminate than Lou Reed. Yeah. I certainly think that, you know, Bowie, who I have huge admiration for, was, you know, I was just, as I was making the notes for this today, I was at a coffee shop, and someone said, you're doing ABBA. And somehow that became Bowie. And they're like, Bowie, well, what was his deal? Was he gay? And I was like, no, Bowie just was.
Everything.
You're right? He was Bowie. You know, and I feel like ABBA is just ABBA. They put out these, you know, hooky poppy songs that were very much a product of the mid to late 70s. It was very much a sound and aesthetic.
They put out the music they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
They were lucky enough to have a manager who could get their stuff out, and they were lucky enough to be able to sing together as a group and write good songs. You know, not everyone who's looking to make music for themselves is looking to make something angry or grimy. Some people just want something that is sappy or beautiful, you know. And one time my father-in-law was like, don't you just like beautiful things? And I kind of like, I don't normally, right? Like, I like, you know, stuff that has an edge that feels like something's there. But sometimes you have a song like this where you just, that song catches and you're like, all right,
yeah,
I can do this.
No, I think, and I find that as I'm getting older especially, the songs I like tend to be way more grandiose or eccentric. You know, I found myself really falling back into Morrissey, who is about as show-toony as one could get.
Yeah, he...
Right?
He has his moments, for sure.
World Inferno Friendship Society, even the, you know, contemporary Mountain Goat stuff, bringing in the saxophone player, is, as far as I'm concerned, it's great. A lot of it borders dangerously close to adult contemporary.
Let's not go there.
But I find myself at this age going, you know, what's a good follow-up to listening to My War yet again? Oh, I know.
ABBA.
Yeah, let me put on the greatest hits of ABBA. I will say that the ABBA's worst song, and probably the one I should have chosen, really, was their version of Pick a Bale of Cotton.
I don't know
the old
that
blues
one.
Song. Oh. You know, how to jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton.
I don't want to see Swedes do that, so we're going to...
It is so deliciously atrocious having them do three covers of blues tunes in a row, and it's a medley, and all
That's
I can
strange.
Picture is like the Brady kids, you know, like with those long flowing pantsuits with the big bottoms and stuff.
Well,
because
you associate that with ABBA. I mean, they're 70s, like almost Bee Gees 70s, maybe even more so than the Bee Gees, I think of as the 70s, as far as pop culture goes. You know?
Yeah, and I'll talk about this again, but, you know, when we talk about, you know, disco music, and I know that ABBA wasn't necessarily disco, but disco was unbelievably empowering. When you look at the folks who made disco, mostly female artists, mostly people of color at right. the beginning, mostly people within the LGBTQ community.
Right.
Those were the forerunners of disco. And their voice was a voice that had been kicked off of, not allowed on radio for years.
Well, they took the same step as like punks did, right?
Yeah.
If we no one wants to hear us, we'll just do it ourselves.
And the main kick against disco was a bunch of white dudes. And there was a DJ out in, I think I've maybe even mentioned this on the show before, but I think he was out in Chicago, and there was like a big doubleheader baseball game, and he was kind of a shock jock. And so he said, well, disco sucks. Everyone bring your disco records and we'll burn them and you get free yeah. admission. And so he was an embittered DJ who had been fired because disco was everywhere and it was so massive and it was so huge that he had a classic rock show that had been booted. And he blamed not his station managers, but disco. And so he really lashed out against this community. And suddenly there were, you know, heteronormative white dudes across the country like, this is an affront to my masculinity. If I hear this song, I might start dancing. And that's, you know.
That's one step away from gay.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so that the war against that, and I think the war against the whole sound and this sort of lighter sound music really began there, in my mind at least. And of course, you know, we get a lot of music since then has really worked to reinforce that. And I think that's kind of a shame. But what I do like, and you were mentioning this earlier, was that Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols was
Glenn,
a fan.
No, Glenn Matlock.
Glenn Matlock, yeah. Sorry.
They actually stole the riff from this chorus, I believe, to be the riff for Pretty Vacant.
That is tremendous.
It's amazing. I would love to, I only just discovered that yesterday, and I would really love to hear them side by side at some point because it blows my mind.
I can cue it up if you want.
Sure.
Let's give that a listen. In the meantime, while I am doing this, other fans of ABBA's SOS, this is ABBA's most covered song. It launched a string of 18 consecutive top 10 hits, which is stunning.
That's nuts. But I think actually the most important factoid about this song is that it is still the only song in which the artist and the song are palindromes.
Oh my gosh. That's pretty good.
Boom.
All right. Let's see if I can one-up you on that one. Both Ray Davies of the Kinks and Peter Townsend are both fans outward, you know, who've spoken out against, spoken out for how great this track is.
Yeah, Peter Townsend for sure. He would play it at home with his kids and everything.
Yeah. And then finally, SOS, three dots, three dashes, three dots with no spaces, is the radio code for danger or need of help.
Yeah.
Does not mean save our souls or save our ship. It was simply chosen because it's a competitive, it's the only 9-element signal in Morse code, and so because it works perfectly as that dot 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 dash 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 dot 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 and can be repeated without break, it's easily recognizable, and that just happens to be the letters associated with the sounds. So here is
interesting.
Pretty Vacant. Just the guitar part for now.
Just seen him, but I don't decide. I got no reason, it's all too much. You'll always wonder.
So I guess I can hear it. Let me try this again.
Yeah, it's just a little more straightforward and not as happy.
Right, yeah. Play it with a little bit of dirt underneath it, and that's what you get.
So this is what the interview says. Did you really steal the riff for Pretty Vacant from ABBA? Yeah, from SOS. Being at art school and being hip to the Dadaists and Marcel Duchamp, you'd nick something and make it your own. If I hadn't come clean, no one would have ever spotted it.
Nice. No, I in my entire life of listening to Nevermind the Bollocks, I never would have made the jump to ABBA from that.
Not only that, because the Sex Pistols seemed like the exact opposite of ABBA at that time, right? They
were
noisy, disjointed, violent, and everything that wasn't ABBA, which was pretty flowers and harmonies, you know what I mean?
Well, they were a mirror reflection in a way, you know, I guess
exactly.
They were the other side of the coin. But how I heard this track was from a guy named Chris Knox, who is from New Zealand, which is close enough to Australia to lend credence to my everybody in Australia loves ABBA connection.
He probably went to Australia at least once.
To hear this song. Well, this is his version of SOS.
SOS take 7. Where are those happy days? It seems so hard to find. I try to reach for you, but you have closed. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice. It used to be so good. So when you near me, love, come near me, yes, away.
Now I'm gonna flat out say, this was pre-Mountain Goats for me. Came out on a Caroline Records sampler called the Bowling Team Sampler. May have been 92. So I hadn't yet heard Sebado. I hadn't yet heard the Mountain Goats.
This was a fish out of water for you.
Yeah, this was a totally different sound from Dinosaur Jr. or the Pixies, 7 Seconds, a lot of the stuff that I was really heavily listening to. But this singer manipulating and tweaking a guitar and just being punk singer songwriter blew me out of the water. This used to be played on my show. I had a show called Holden Caulfield Must Die, and it was a radio show on MUH Allentown, and I used to play this song every episode and just scream myself hoarse just screaming along with
Chris
Knox.
Now, at the time, did you know it was a cover of ABBA or ABBA?
No, I didn't. I didn't know it until 2 years later when I went to Australia.
Okay.
And I was like, wait a second, what the fuck is this?
Right, this is all gross.
No, I mean...
Did you love the original as well right away?
Yeah, and my whole take on covers, I'm really... You were saying earlier that, you know, with The Man in the Mirror, that you were kind of let down by finding out that somebody else had written about it, you know, had written the song.
Yeah.
That's how I felt about covers.
Yeah.
And the first break in my heart was Good Guys Don't Wear White by the Standells, covered by Minor Threat.
Yeah.
Because I had heard Minor Threat do it, and I was like, this is the best song on the album, as far as I'm concerned. It's
Oh, that's because it was done by a professional.
Yeah. This wasn't done by an 18-year-old kid screaming about how he's drug-free. This is the Standells. It makes sense.
Right.
And after that, my love affair, I don't particularly, I listen to covers, I'm interested in covers, but I don't form the same bond with covers.
What the cover actually does to me a lot of the time is make me go, you were interested in enough, like I like this band, that band X, and you guys like this song enough to cover it, wonder why. And I go back and I listen to whatever the original was and kind of try to understand it from there. Covers are fun, but that's one of the reasons why I don't like bands that have someone write songs for them.
Yeah.
Because it's not, there's no personal connection to me. For me, I mean, yeah, you can make them a personal connection, but I think that you go, the task of writing a song is a lot different than just being like, well, these lyrics are pretty cool. Let's sing them, you know?
I think there's a certain amount of authenticity that comes with a bad song, even written by a performer, and saying, well, you know,
I don't love the songs you're writing, but it's you putting in the effort and the work. And
well, it goes back to the whole thing with parents listening to music that the kids are listening to and going, this is just garbage. Anyone can do this. That's right. Anyone can do it.
Yeah.
But number one, you're not.
Yeah.
So until you've tried it, it's a lot harder than it looks to even write a simple 3-chord punk song.
Yeah, of course. And to make it hooky and to hit the right notes and to create that sing-along bit, you know,
to make it interesting.
Right.
There has to be some kind of dynamics to it at some point.
I always feel that way when I go to art shows or I go to like craft fairs. I know those are two opposite ends of the spectrum, but I always get awkward when people are like, well, I could have made this. I could easily paint that. Oh, I could do that. You didn't.
Right.
And you haven't. And you're not going to. So,
stop shitting on someone who did.
Right. Either buy it or say, this isn't my jam, and walk away.
And that's totally fine, too. That's the whole point of this podcast. This is not my jam, but I can appreciate it and then go, all right, I'm going to move on.
Right, precisely. And moving on, let's talk about your picks. So Chris had sent us a request.
Yes.
He said he wanted us to talk about
David Sanborn, The Dream.
And if you don't know David Sanborn, The Dream, it is, how would you best explain it?
I would best explain it as, since you know Kenny G, and I'm sure you do, it's Kenny G, but his name is David Sanborn. It is adult contemporary saxophone music, and I believe the text I sent Eric was, this song is going to kill me, I believe.
Well, it's got kind of that monk, you know, it's got that, like, what was that big in the 80s, the monks who sing, what do you call them? Right, it's got that little bit of the synthesizer, that ABBA sound.
Yeah, synthesized harpsichord there, right. Or whatever.
So it's got the synthesized harpsichord, say that five times fast.
Coming.
It's got the Gregorian chanting.
The Gregorian chants, that's.
And more importantly, it has this, which is going to come in a couple of seconds here, I believe.
It will come eventually, and then we'll all be sad.
And you'll regret it.
It's almost there.
So this, to me, is the only way to talk about this is the slow love scene in every 80s buddy cop film. This is where, like, Mel Gibson gets it on with, you know, Rene Russo. This is where, Bruce Willis calls his wife.
Exactly. This is, I don't even know where to go. And the only thing that I have for notes when we talked about this for about 8 hours, I think, before we died was that David Sanborn performed with Albert King and Little Milton at the age of 14, which is pretty dope.
Which gives him some, which almost, there's no apology now for that music.
Right, because he knew what good music
was. Little Walter at 14.
No, Little Milton.
Little Milton, oh, sorry. Well, regardless.
And it's little, not lil, so.
God damn it. So we decided to go a different direction and choose two songs that have come out within the last few months and do a little bit of, like, albums we think you should get or music we think you should pick up.
And
so, Chris, thank you for sending us from your beautiful work vacation some David Sanborn, but you definitely have a lot to answer for when you return to the show.
I feel like there's a text on my phone that says, you've been punked.
Right. I feel like there's another song. I mean, talk about not my jam. This really is not anybody's jam. I mean, I think that the people whose jam this was are all retired and have gone deaf.
Well, it was good when I was in the elevator going from somewhere to someplace else.
When I was trying not to think of the dentist's drill.
Right.
That harpsichord, really. Yeah, definitely. So you chose Chelsea Wolfe, 16 Psyche.
Yeah.
And let's give it a little bit of a listen.
We'll be right back.
So I guess the first thing I'd say after that is I think that choosing a really dark song and a dark album was required after listening to SOS and Man in the Mirror for 3 or 4 days straight.
Well, you need something to balance out, a little bit of bitterness to balance out the sweetness.
Right, exactly.
So you sent this to me and I had never heard of her before. So I started to dig in and figure out, you know, what it was about Chelsea Wolfe.
Yeah.
And so I was amazed at the spectrum of her career. And I feel as though, why don't more people know about her? Because she did a folk album. She did kind of like this dark folk stuff for a while. Then she does this, I don't know, this kind of, she did a cover of, she did a whole album of anarcho-punk band Rudimentary Peni.
Covers, yeah.
Like, you know, and I know we just had our whole big thing about not liking covers, but nobody covers Rudimentary Peni. Like, nobody covers Conflict, and nobody covers Crass.
Especially someone who's been releasing folk albums, and, you know, she's all over the place, but I feel like she's, the reason why no one knows her is she's grown from where she was to this. Some of this stuff is really dark sounding. You know, this song is from her fifth album, Hispun, recorded in Salem, Massachusetts, with Kurt Ballou from Converge at God City Studios. So the whole album is dark. And even the themes inside the album are dark. She talks about it being about her family tragedies, her own psychic issues, addiction, that kind of thing. And then they choose this, Salem has a history of abusing women, essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah.
And Kurt Ballou obviously is renowned as Converge's guitarist, but also his studio was renowned for having great sound, you know, and being a good place to record your noisy album.
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of this goth folk.
Yep.
I don't think it's quite, I know that it's listed as like different kinds of like sludge metal and stuff like that, but it really is like a much darker folk music. And I'm impressed. I mean, she's been on, her music's been on Game of Thrones, 12 Monkeys TV show, The Walking Dead, The Far Cry, a Jaguar, 2017 Jaguar commercial.
That one kind of blew me away when I saw that Jaguar would use it, but it had to be some sort of spacey something or other, I would guess.
But I think with bands that cover such a wide spectrum, there's usually one point when you're listening to stuff, be it their cover album or some of their earlier stuff, where you just think, man, these guys are playing. Yeah. You know, these are just posers, and they're just, you know, here's the sound that they're clearly not meant for. But she has such control and such resonance, and she's able to capture every sound that she seems to be going for. Now, I only did about a 2-hour dive into her
right.
career retrospective, but, I mean, she's right on the money with the way everything should sound.
What I liked about her was just the progression. You know, she's really gone from folk. She got a little darker, a little darker, a little darker, a little darker, and just kept going into the point where now she's entrenched with really heavy music. I want to just bring up the fact that the lead guitar player on this track and a couple others on this record is done by Troy Van Leeuwen, known for playing with Queens of the Stone Age, Failure, and also as a point of reference to your Fear of a Dork Planet podcast co-host, Maynard James Keenan's Perfect Circle.
Right, well, I can't escape that guy anywhere I go.
I know, that's why I had to bring it.
Well, and also Aaron Turner from Isis.
That's correct. He played, did he play on this song?
I don't think he's on this song, but he's definitely on this album.
Right.
So, the idea of, I can't make the sound, but I know where to go to make that sound.
Right.
You know, when we talk about, we joke around about, you know, Trump, and I don't want to get political, but, you know, I surround myself with the best people. Well, it works when you do it.
Right.
Like, when you actually choose people who know what they're doing and you bring them in.
It's not just that they know what they're doing, but they know what you're trying to do, and they're trying to bring that out of you. So one of the good things about a producer, I was just listening to someone the other day. I have no idea who it was. It's like floating around in my head, but he was like, I'm a producer. I can tell you how to play this song, but I want you to play the song, and I want to make you the best you can be, basically. So pulling out all the good bits, the things that make you special or unique or different, that's what I'm trying to pull out of you. And I think that she's done a good job at, number one, knowing what she wants, and number two, surrounding herself with people who can do what she wants.
And, you know, I'm even just watching the video, and I think, like,
This video looks like a Marilyn Manson video directed by Glenn Danzig.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know if you noticed she doesn't blink in that video.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed that. I did know that her eyes are in this video amazing. Whoa. Like, they're such a central focus.
Right.
Which I guess now makes sense that she doesn't blink. I should probably watch it again with that in mind.
I think it's the psychosis that she's trying to portray in the video. I mean, it's that video is very, I won't say claustrophobic almost.
It's a hard video to watch.
Yeah.
It's got, you know, the smoke. There's a part where, you know, a few minutes in where the screen is circled. Like, yeah. You're looking through like almost like a pinhole camera.
Yeah.
And there's this smoke in the background, but it's kind of this almost glaucoma.
Yeah. It's
like as if those are our eyes and that's what we're seeing out of. And again, I like somebody whose idea of art encompasses so much that they even think about how this is going to come across visually.
Right. I think that's where she's taken that darkness from her youth. Her dad is like a country musician of some kind. And she's taken that kind of folky country stuff and completely just made that dark, I think.
Yeah. Well, we did this a couple of weeks ago with a band called The Bad Signs out of Nashville, who sound as if they are sort of a dreamy psych pop thing, but they're heavily engrossed in country music. And what they're doing is they're taking the structure of a country song and the thematic resonance of a country song and pushing it to its next limit, saying, okay, we've done the trucks and dogs and we've done the fake yodel and we've done the fake accents and stuff like that for authenticity's sake.
Right.
Now, let's expand on what a country song is capable of doing. And it's got a natural, early country stuff has a natural darkness to it.
Well, I think what most people our age think of country, we actually are thinking of pop country. We're not thinking of true country music. We're thinking of stuff that broke through and has just enough twang and just enough southern accent to sound like it's from the South and being country. Whereas true country was like the blues or punk, where it was people that were living a day to day making songs about their lives. And yeah, that can turn into pickup trucks and dogs or whatever, but it doesn't have to be there.
Well, to me, the idea of country always was that sort of, when we go back to this masculinity, like, I'm a man, I can't cry, but I wrote this song, and this song's really sad, but I can cry over this song, and that's okay.
Right.
You know, it's the idea of, I'm not going to write poetry while I'm out here on the trail, because poetry is, you know, for intellectual weenies.
Right.
I'm going to write this song instead. When, ironically, there was history of, in the 1800s, with the post-westward expansion and the building up the West Coast, those towns were so isolated that they would put on their own performances. And one of the most popular things to do were Shakespeare plays.
Really?
And when Shakespeare troops would come out there, they would get corrected and stage notes from like minors. You know, and I love the idea of some guy who's given it up, he's lived in the woods for ages, and he's sitting there watching like Henry V, and he's like, nah, you got the line wrong.
Right.
You know, like, you don't want line readings from some guy who's just been, you know, punching, punching bears. I don't know. So
I think, just going back to the song for a second, 16 Psyche is the 16th asteroid discovered and is one of the 10 most massive asteroids in the asteroid belt. So I have absolutely no idea what that has to do with this song in general, but that's the name of the song. I don't really know what it has to do with the song.
I don't either, because I didn't look up the lyrics, actually. I didn't have enough time to prep.
I can read the lyrics to you, because there's only about six. I can't, she said. I'd save you, but I can't hide. But I skipped something. Start over. Verse 1. I spent in different beds many moons, and that's why the way I prefer it. I can't, she said. I'd save you, but I can't hide. I feel it crawl up my legs, let me wrap you up in these thighs, gets me out of my head again. I can't, she said, I'd save you, but I can't love.
I'm going to stop here. This sounds exactly like, do you ever watch the old Testimony Against Hip-Hop?
Yes.
Where there'd be some senator reading hip-hop lyrics? This is exactly what that sounds like now.
Good.
Right?
So I'm
bass,
sounding...
How low can you go? Death row, what a brother know. Once again, back is the incredible. Yeah.
And then she says, 16 psyche, coma, tail quivering, knew all along. I can't, she said, I'd save you, but I can't. She said, I'd save you, but the world's bent. She said, I'd save you, but I can't. I have no idea what that has to do with 16 psyche, but it's interesting to me.
Well, let's move from psyche to psychedelic. And perfect. Here is my choice of new music to soothe your mellow ears. So this is Baronin and Satan, and they are actually helping us loop around the first half of the show because they are from Gothenburg, Sweden. And I thought that they made a great connection to Chelsea Wolf, because Chelsea Wolf is goth folk. Baronin and Satan qualify themselves as garage death, and that is their label of music.
That's their genre.
That's
I would have guessed the cramps with Susie and the Banshee, Susie singing there.
Well, I think that's hilarious because when I sent you this yesterday, the text that you sent back immediately was, this is the Cramps with Susie singing. And then as you started to look them up online...
That's how they described them.
That is exactly how someone had previously described them.
We're not as special as we think we are.
No, but clearly... that's the category they belong in. So if you like Cramps, if you like Susie, then I think you'll like Baronin and Satan. But here's how I had them described. I had them described as a 60s Neo Manson California brown acid trip death cult. And that was my concept of what this whole sound is.
And this is why you're an English teacher and I'm just not someone.
This to me... is when I think of, whenever you read Ken Kesey, and Ken Kesey talks about, Ken Kesey wrote Demon Box, he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Okay.
He was a big progenitor of the Merry Pranksters, these people who drove around the country completely stoned out of their gourd.
Yeah.
He had a farm up in the California hills, and you could pretty much just come and hang out, and it was very sort of hippie, commune-esque. But of course, bikers hung out there. So it wasn't just, it was dangerous. It was very much outlaw society.
Right.
These are people who pulled themselves off the map. This is precisely the kind of music I think of when I think of that or I think of 60s biker films.
Yeah, I can see this being played at one of those places. Everything's kind of turned up to 11 because you don't quite have the proper equipment to do everything, so everything gets a little distorted and grungy, but it stays in that kind of psychobilly a little bit, but also more, it's, I think, more straight ahead than psychobilly is.
Yeah, and I mean, I've said this a bunch of times on the show, but I've never done hallucinogenics. I think in a perfect world, I would try them, but I'm not going to because I live under that fear of too many of those videos when I was a kid.
Thriller?
Yeah, exactly. Do you remember the videos when you were in like elementary school and they were like, here's a video about LSD.
Right.
I thought I was Superman and I jumped out of a building. I lost all of my limbs.
Right. That would be me too if I took hallucinogenics.
Precisely. And so I've always sought the non-drug version of hallucinogenics. So I've always liked psych music or books that were really strange and occultish or... movies that were a little uncomfortable in that kind of way.
Well, it gives you a vision of what psychedelics might do to you.
Yeah, and then I can operate heavy machinery afterwards or go for a walk or, call my grandma. Like, I can do lots of different things.
And you still have all your limbs.
Exactly. And so this to me puts me in that chair without ever having to be there.
Yeah.
I will say, go out if you like Baronin and Satan. Definitely, when you download the album, listen to it on headphones. It is a headphone experience.
Is it?
They really manipulate the left and right side speakers. They're pretty strong. They're also from, as I said, from Gothenburg, Sweden. I only know Gothenburg from a Mountain Goat song. And so Chris and I were talking about bringing in a thing called Mountain Notes, where I bring in like...
the Mountain Goats every time.
Exactly. And John Darnielle had an album called Hail and Farewell Gothenburg. The pitch on it, though, was recorded wrong. So he pulled it. And there are bootleg copies out there, but he pretty much disavows the entire album. I was at a show one time and someone yelled for him to play a track off it. And he stops. He's like, I don't know what song you're talking about. I've never written a song like that in all, you know? So there's this wonderful, talk about psychedelia. There's this wonderful ignoring of the facts to get to, you know, skipping point B to get from A to C.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really wonderful as well. But anyway, I love the sound of this band. I've been trying to bring them into the show for a very long time and find a way to do it. So I think as a way of a palate cleanser for...
the first two songs?
Yep. And bringing it back into Sweden. You know, 50% of this show is like an IKEA catalog.
Right. And I think it's actually good. We're showing the entire spectrum of what can happen in music. We had, you know, beautiful songs at the beginning that were like, quote, touching and enjoyable and like all had these different feelings. And then you kind of just realize that, you know, sometimes dark music can do the same thing. You know, some people resonate better with a noisier or more, a negative, quote, feeling about, you know, I feel negative. And if this person feels negative, we bond over that. Some people want to hear happy songs to feel better. Other people want to commiserate in their sadness.
I like commiserating in sadness. I think that that's, you know, I'm a pretty big fan of that as we listen to music. That's why I come to music, I think, is that shared communal experience.
When you feel like crap and someone sings a song and you go, hey, I feel that.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel less alone maybe or less sad. But at the same time, you know, if you're that personality, you don't tend to like happy songs, I think.
Yeah, I have my therapist calls it resting melancholy face. I brought in a bunch of pictures one time, and I was like, you know, these are pictures from me growing up. See, I'm never a big smiler. He's like, yeah, you have resting melancholy face. Don't worry about it. Like, that's what I want from a therapist. And with that, folks, we are. Would you like to read us out, Chris?
I'll read us out, Chris. Wait, I'm Chris. Are we gonna do the topic engine or?
We're gonna do that after. Let's do that first. Ready?
Okay.
So, Chris. I'm firing up the old topic engine. And
it sounds good.
Since you are a guest here, you get to choose from this sophisticated device.
I'm impressed by it. It's more sophisticated than I could have ever imagined.
All right, let's see what you got.
Doom.
All right, so the topic of our next show is simply...
Doom.
And I think that there's a lot of ways to go with that. That is D-O-O-M with an exclamation point.
And the M has a fancy little thing that makes me think of metal. So we are on the internet at Radio Mutation, Podbean, iTunes, and CutXCut.com. Send bonus tracks and comments to CutXCutPodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram at CutXCutPodcast. Check out playlists for the season on Spotify. And head over to iTunes to give us a review. Cue up the topic engine for next week. And next week's topic engine is Doom.
So we will see you then. Chris... thanks for filling in. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks. I had some big shoes to fill, and hopefully I did okay.
The other Chris is ginormous. He's tall. I mean, he's like...
he barely fits in this room.
He's like 50 feet.
It's difficult to fit in those shoes. I may fit in one shoe as a whole person.
Well, you know what they say. Don't judge another man until you've taken his shoes and thrown them over a telephone wire.
With him still in it. Nope.